Today's broadcast is brought to you in part by Corporate Capital Direct. Listen, banks are not lending, and the online lenders may not tell you all you need to hear to make the right decision for your company needs. Get the inside edge for business financing. Whether you have capital needs for inventory, payroll, general operating expenses, or even to consolidate expensive debt or tax issues, Corporate Capital Direct can help you avoid common mistakes when seeking a capital solution for your business. Never upfront fees. Get the inside edge for your business financing needs. Call Corporate Capital Direct at 800-261-6478 or go to corpcapdirect.com. Again, call Corporate Capital Direct at 800-261-6478 or go to corpcapdirect.com. Welcome to the award-winning legal news and review recognized from the Florida Bar Award of Excellence, featuring the law firm of Santucci Fiore Fiel, practicing intellectual property, business and entertainment law and litigation. Located in downtown Fort Lauderdale is Mike Santucci, legal panel attorney who co-chairs the intellectual property section of the Broward Bar. Legal News and Review, the only real problem solver radio program using the law, with your moderator, Philip Bell, and legal panel attorney, Gary Singer, chair of the Broward County Bar Association's Real Property Section. Gary Singer is board certified in real estate law, also syndicated columnist from the Sun Sentinel. He is an expert in his fields of practice. And nationally known criminal defense attorney, Gary Ostro, Esquire. Over 30 years defending the accused in both state and federal courts. With over 500 jury trials to his credit, Gary Ostro's practice focuses on Fourth Amendment issues as related to search and seizure, as well as federal civil rights cases against police officers, as well as the departments and city in which they operate. Now, here's your moderator, Philip Bell.
On the docket for today's broadcast, the United States Supreme Court last week rules 8-0, and that means it's unanimous for police in a major Fourth Amendment case. Today, we're very pleased to have Tom Rene, who is a civil and criminal appeals attorney, who has won appeals in the Florida Supreme Court and all five of Florida's district courts of appeal, along with the U.S. Court of Appeals of the 11th Circuit. Tom handles appeals in Florida state and federal cases. But first, I'd like to welcome our legal panel host, Gary Ostro. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Great to be here. Thank you, Phil.
Well, you're standing all alone because Mike Santucci and Gary Singer will be back next week.
I didn't notice they weren't here.
Well, you got big shoulders. You could handle it. And Tom, welcome to Legal News and Review.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Last time you were on, we were at Alpine Jaguar.
That's right.
And you did a great job, sincerely.
I missed the cars.
Yeah.
Alpine has some fine merchandise, and we're not plugging them for any other reason.
No, not at all.
Then it's the truth.
Yeah. No, they don't pay me anymore, but they're
right.
Great. They really are. Tom, I'm going to start out with you. In terms of this decision, what does this actually mean? And how does this address Fourth Amendment issues?
Well, I think that the problem that the Supreme Court had with the Ninth Circuit decision was not so much the way it came out, but the process of reasoning that they used. Because the Ninth Circuit had basically developed a rule of its own called the provocation doctrine. And that meant that if there was a situation where excessive force might have been used, if they found that excessive force wasn't used, they could look backward in time to see if there was some earlier Fourth Amendment violation. And if there was, then they could basically claim that there was excessive force based on that. And what the Supreme Court says, and Gary, correct me if I get any of this wrong, but the Supreme Court basically said, well, that's incorrect reasoning. You know, if there's no excessive force in the situation, then there's no excessive force. You can't say that there was because there was some earlier Fourth Amendment violation. But you can basically sue on the basis of that earlier Fourth Amendment violation. So
I think by way of illustration, can you give us an example that would simplify this whole theory?
Right. Well, yeah, let me just talk about what happened in the case.
Sure. Okay, sure.
So the case was the police were looking for some a suspect, and they had a felony arrest warrant for the person. And they had some information that he might be in a house belonging to a Mrs. Hughes. So they went to Mrs. Hughes's house, and two of the deputies were searching in the backyard, and they had been told that there was a shack in the backyard where the Mendezes lived, Mr. Mendez and actually Ms. Garcia, as she was at the time, although now she's Mrs. Mendez.
Right.
They were told that they were living in a shack. One of the deputies said he didn't remember that.
Was he one of the fugitives? Was this the fugitive?
He wasn't the fugitive, no. These were
okay.
just some
incidental people.
Exactly. These were basically two people that, well, they called them homeless, except that the shack was their home.
Right, okay.
So they were living in the shack, and the two deputies get to the shack, and probably based on the idea that there might be a dangerous person there, they didn't have a warrant.
They did not have a search warrant.
Did not have
correct.
A search warrant.
Yeah.
To
or an
search
arrest
the
warrant. Did they have an arrest warrant?
No. Well, not. They had an arrest warrant for Mr. O'Dell,
right. okay.
the guy they were looking for, but not for the Mendezes.
Right.
So they didn't have a search warrant, and also they did not knock and announce. They just sprang in. And Mr. Mendez had a BB gun that he used to kill rats, basically. And so he's got the BB gun when they burst in. He's got the BB gun in a situation where it looks like it's a real gun to them.
Right.
And so they fire. And they fired 15 rounds and very serious injuries to both people. Yes, Mr. Mendez had the lower part of his right leg amputated eventually. And so very serious injuries. So basically what the Ninth Circuit looked at was they said, well, there's the lack of a warrant, that's a Fourth Amendment violation. Then there's the lack of knocking and announcing, that's a Fourth Amendment violation. And then there's the possibility of excessive force. Well, now, the trouble with the excessive force argument is if you forget about the search warrant, the lack of a search warrant, the lack of knock and announce, a policeman who's in that situation and sees what appears to be a gun pointed at him can use lethal force. So they're saying it's not excessive force if you just take that by itself. And so the Supreme Court basically said, well, you can't say that it's now an extreme force case because of those two other violations. It's, you know, you just do the extreme force analysis by itself.
But the Ninth Circuit Court rejected the officer's pleas for what's called a qualified immunity. What does that actually mean?
Well, do you want to explain that, Gary?
Typically, officers are immune from civil liability as long as they're acting within the scope, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're they act excessively or outside the scope in a way that's where they don't have the protection of that immunity, then they're not immune from civil liability.
Right. Now, I believe that the Ninth Circuit said that they had qualified immunity on the on one of the earlier counts. One of the other violations.
But finish up the reasoning, because you were explaining that.
Right.
But I want to hear the rest.
Okay, right. So basically, the Supreme Court says, you can't make that that situation, that use of force, excessive force, by itself without by bringing in those other two Fourth Amendment violations. But they did say you can sue based on the earlier Fourth Amendment violation. So they could say that the lack of a search warrant or the lack of knock and announce is a proximate cause of their injuries, and they can sue for their injuries based
but
on that.
But that wasn't the final decision, was it?
Of the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
Yes, that's what the Supreme
Court
said.
Oh, it was. Okay.
The Supreme Court said that, yes. And really, they're not really saying that these people can't recover for their injuries. They're saying that really this provocation rule that the Ninth Circuit came up with did not make sense.
And when did they come up with that? Has that been in existence for some time?
That's been in existence in the Ninth Circuit for a while.
Because I'm not familiar with it. I've never heard of it before.
Yes.
This case.
Right. Yeah. And that's because this is the Supreme Court's first chance to knock it down. They're not saying that these people can't recover for their injuries. They're basically saying that this rule that the Ninth Circuit created out of thin air, more or less, doesn't really make sense. And you do each step of the analysis for each Fourth Amendment violation individually and don't mix them up with each other. I think that's really the message of it.
So how do you think this is going to impact police and their procedures in executing warrants such as this? What's going to change, if anything? And what should change? well, a result of this decision?
What I mean, the policemen, the two officers in this case messed up any way you want to look at it, really, because...
Did they have an exigent circumstance argument?
No.
Apparently not.
Well, they did have an exigent circumstance argument that they used in the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit did not...
Struck it down.
They didn't go along with that.
There were no facts to support it.
They didn't see anybody fleeing into the building.
No furtive movements.
They didn't hear anybody yelling, help, come save me, or something like that. So really, the exigent circumstance argument went nowhere. And the Ninth Circuit did talk about the fact that the shack was in the curtilage of the house, of Mrs. Hughes's house. But because somebody's living there, that's their home. So you need a warrant for that particular place. And so they didn't have a warrant for that place. And so that's just basic. You know, you can't search somebody's house without a warrant.
Or consent.
Or consent, yes. Or an exigent circumstance in some cases. But yeah.
And they didn't even seek consent in this case.
No, and because there was no knock and announce. And
right.
If they had done that, if they'd knocked and announced, this might not have happened.
They probably would have avoided the injuries.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yes.
But again, this was the county of Los Angeles versus Menendez. And this was a case, Tom, back in 2010 when the case actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking now 2017,
mm-hmm.
halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
Is that common when it comes to appeals of this nature?
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, because it'll take years for it to get through the state courts and up all the different levels and get to the Supreme Court. So that's not unusual at all. When you look at a lot of Supreme Court cases and you look at when the incident occurred and when the Supreme Court is deciding it, that's not too unusual.
Now, people know about the Fifth Amendment. People plead the Fifth, most recently in the news, especially for these figures up before Congress are going to plead the Fifth. Gary Ostro likes pleading the Fifth.
Well, but I advise my clients to. I don't know about me.
Well, I mean, you know what I mean.
He doesn't need to.
He doesn't need to. That's right.
Not yet.
But what actually is the Fourth Amendment to us common Americans? What does it actually protect us from?
Well, the Fourth Amendment says that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seen.
And that is the exact language of the Fourth Amendment.
Yes.
You just heard it.
So. Yes.
But in your criminal cases, I'm assuming that you use that.
I find Fourth Amendment issues in 90% of my drug cases, if not more, where there's a warrantless search, where there's alleged consent, where there's a defective warrant because the affidavit that was filed in support of the warrant is defective, or there's a material misrepresentation which makes the warrant defective. There are so many Fourth Amendment issues in the cases that I've come across, or I seem to have a knack for finding them, but there seem to be a lot of agencies that don't have as much respect for the Fourth Amendment as you would like to see as a defense lawyer. So it's a fair game. And it's virtually limitless in its use when it comes to cases of narcotic seizures and arrests. I find it to be prevalent, to say the least, to be conservative. In about every case, I find the Fourth Amendment issue, if not a violation. So it's an enormously effective defense tool for a lawyer who litigates criminal defense cases.
Well, I know that when we had Judge Levinson on, and at the time, he's now a civil judge, but at the time he was a criminal judge, he said that you were one of the most prepared attorneys before his court, and very passionate. You know, you really made your point, and that's just it. When people rights are violated, you know, they need an advocate, advocate like yourself.
Well, as I'm sure Tom would agree, the Fourth Amendment, other than the practical aspects, the fact that the officers that violate it, there's a punishment, and the punishment for their violating that, other than a possible 1983 civil rights lawsuit, is suppressing the evidence that was seized unlawfully. And that's what we hope would re-educate, I'll use that term to be fair, these officers who might violate the Fourth Amendment, that next time you got to think about, you know, how you go about seizing evidence or executing a warrant or obtaining a warrant when you fill out your sworn affidavit. Because if you don't do it right, there's guys out there that are going to, take you to task. And That's the whole point of the Fourth Amendment and a motion to suppress evidence that's obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment. My job is to get them to think next time, wait a minute, I better do this right. And I know, you know, plenty of officers, street-level narcotics guys that I'm friendly with that do it, try to go out of their way to do it right, knowing if they don't do it right, that the state's not going to file the case. They're going to see a defect in the procedures that they followed or didn't follow. And it's a great tool. If they ever abolish that, the suppression concept, we're done. We're done. This country is done. And I fear that. I fear that with some Supreme Court prospective members. It may come to time, and I'm sure Tom agrees, or I'm not going to speak for Tom. I'd like to hear from Tom on that issue, but that's one of our greatest protections constitutionally. That's alive and well in every court. Now, there are judges that will never grant the motion to suppress. I'm not naming them.
But they know who they are.
They know who they are. Let's leave it at that.
Well, yes, and I think, you know, you're talking about the exclusionary rule here where the court can exclude evidence that's been illegally seized. And, you know, I've given lectures on the Constitution, and I will show the words of the Fourth Amendment to my audience, and I'll say, okay, now what's missing from that?
The exclusionary rule is missing.
What's missing is there's no way to enforce it. It doesn't say how you're going to enforce it. So what if they don't follow this rule? What if they seize some evidence and they didn't follow the Fourth Amendment? Did you say, oh, well, that's too bad?
The remedy is missing.
Yes, exactly. Right? The remedy. There's got to be. So the courts had to come up with this to make sure that there was some way that there would be a deterrent for a policeman from violating the Fourth Amendment. And so sometimes the policeman will say, well, hey, the guy was guilty, you know, and I got the evidence. Well, yeah, but you could have gotten a warrant and you didn't, and you have to get a warrant. Otherwise, police can just violate everybody's privacy whenever they feel like it. And then if they come up with some evidence of a crime, they'll say, well, see, I was justified. Here's the evidence.
The ends justify the means. And exactly. There are officers that think that way, even in light of the exclusionary rule.
Yes.
Well, the guy's guilty, and I know it, and you know it, and the judge knows it. I'm going to do what I got to do, and I'm regardless of the Fourth Amendment. Those are the guys we have to weed out.
You know, we're going to have to take a quick break. You're listening to Legal News and Review on WSBR, which is 96.9, 103.9, 740. And I'd like to welcome our national listeners on iHeart, TuneIn, and iRadio Now. And we're speaking with Tom Renier. And I pronounce it right?
Renier.
Renier.
Yes.
I'll get it right. Someone's going to do a shot on me at the Nova School of Law. But in all seriousness, you've had successful cases in appeals.
Yes.
And one issue that I know that Gary will love to listen to has to do about racially biased juries. Were you you actually were on an appeal on that?
Okay, yes. Well, that was an interesting case.
But we're going to go back to that, and we're going to be right back.
Today's broadcast is brought to you in part by Corporate Capital Direct. Listen, banks are not lending, and the online lenders may not tell you all you need to hear to make the right decision for your company needs. Get the inside edge for business financing. Whether you have capital needs for inventory, payroll, general operating expenses, or even to consolidate expensive debt or tax issues, Corporate Capital Direct can help you avoid common mistakes when seeking a capital solution for your business. Never upfront fees. Get the inside edge for your business financing needs. Call Corporate Capital Direct at 800-261-6478 or go to corpcapdirect.com. Again, call Corporate Capital Direct at 800-261-6478 or go to corpcapdirect.com.
Welcome back to Legal News and Review, recipient of the Award of Excellence from the Florida Bar, featuring Michael Santucci of the law firm Santucci Priori, practicing intellectual property, business, and entertainment law and litigation, located in downtown Fort Lauderdale. Reach them at 500law.com or 954-351-7474. To contact the legal panel hosts and guests, go online to belegalbuzz.com. Once again, here's your moderator, Philip Bell.
Legal Legal News and Review is back on the air. This is Philip Bell speaking. I'm here with legal panel host Gary Ostro, and Michael Santucci and Gary Singer will be back next week. And we're speaking with appellate attorney, civil and criminal appellate attorney, Tom Renier. Oh, hey, no applause? Yeah, all right.
First time for everything.
Yep. That's why I just call him Tom, and everyone calls him Tom. Everyone knows Tom.
Much easier.
Yeah, absolutely. And we were just speaking about the first part of the segment regarding the Supreme Court that ruled unanimously, and that's unanimously for police in a major Fourth Amendment case. And I'd like to transition as well into the case that you were talking to me about off air, which had to do about a racially biased jury that after the case you were employed for an appeal. What actually happened on that?
Okay, so that was a situation where basically it was a charge of driving with license suspended. And it happened that the defendant was black, which is relevant in this case. And at the beginning of the trial, when they're picking the jury, the prosecutor says to the prospective jurors there, he says, does anyone here believe that racial profiling is prevalent in the community? And so several jurors raised their hands, including some black jurors. And so he asked them about their opinions on racial profiling, and some of them told about situations they'd been involved in where they felt they were racially profiled. And some of them said they hadn't actually been racially profiled themselves, but they had friends who had been. And all of them were asked, well, do you still feel that you can be fair and impartial when you hear a policeman testify? And they all said yes. So then we get to the stage where they're doing peremptory challenges. Now, a peremptory challenge, you're supposed to be able to get rid of the juror that you don't like for any reason, except okay. It's not supposed to be racial or gender-based or ethnicity or anything like that. All three of these black jurors who had said they believe racial
were challenged.
All of them were challenged. Yes, and the defense said, "Well, these are black jurors. Give us a race-neutral reason for why you're taking them off the jury." And the prosecutor said, "Well, I'm taking them off because they believe racial profiling is prevalent in the community." And
it is a race-neutral reason.
Well,
it is.
That's not what the appellate court.
But I believe it is.
There's more to it than that. And of course, well, their argument is, of course, anybody can believe that racial profiling is prevalent.
Right. That's why it's not racially relevant.
Except that what I argued to the court was that this was basically a ploy to elicit information from black jurors that could be used to get them off of the jury.
But clearly, if I'm the defense lawyer and I ask that question, the state's going to strike those jurors and vice versa. So you're kind of – you're giving them up your hand. You're showing your hand by showing jurors that are black. I would stay away from that question with them because I don't want to give the state a reason to strike those jurors for cause or preemptorily, which, you know, they may do race neutral or not. I don't want to bring attention to them. I would probably avoid that question.
Well, it's the prosecutor that brought up the question.
Okay. Well, if I'm the prosecutor, he's trying to find a reason to strike them for cause. But I don't think their response is a legitimate basis to argue that's a strike for cause.
I think you're correct on that, especially since they all said that they could be impartial when they listened to police testimony.
Right.
But there is a case in the U.S. Supreme Court, New York versus Hernandez, and that had to do with striking any jurors who spoke Spanish.
Wow.
And
that's racially.
Well,
that's
see,
a, it's not a racial neutral reason.
Well, the thing is, anybody can learn to speak Spanish. You don't have to be Hispanic by birth. So you can make that same argument. But the Supreme Court said it's a way of pulling out the Hispanic jurors and getting them off. And it's the same thing with this. I argued that this was a similar situation. And when I went to the third DCA and argued this, they agreed with me. And they said that was very troubling that he would ask that question. Now, there was no indication that racial profiling was going to be an issue in the case.
But that's not the point.
But the point is that if it had been, that would be justified. But the court said that this was basically a subterfuge to get black jurors off of the jury.
Right.
So that was.
And I can see the argument, and I like the analogy that you made where the other Spanish-speaking people were knocked off, because clearly the implication is you're looking to knock off Latinos.
Yes.
Because that's their native language, and yeah, anybody can speak Swahili. But the point is the native language is of those people.
They were letting Swahili speakers stay on.
Right,
the jury,
of course they were. Yes, of course. So it was a good ploy, but thanks to guys like you, we keep the system in check. You know?
Exactly. And, you know, Tom, you're so passionate, attorney. You actually put on these seminars.
Well, I've been doing a continuing legal education recently. It's called Hamlet and the Law of Homicide. I talk about how the law of homicide is reflected in the play Hamlet by Shakespeare.
And attorneys that attend can get CLE credits?
Attorneys can get CLE credit. I've given this for the Dade County Bar Association, Miami Beach Bar Association, Weston Bar Association.
Well, I wish as always we had more time. And just because you think you have a case for an appeal, it doesn't mean you're right. If you lose, it doesn't mean you... It's a matter of record in the law, correct?
Yes.
You don't retry the case as an appeal. And Tom, what is the best way to contact you?
Best way to contact me would be to go to my website, which is tomrenierappeals.com, or you can email me at tom@tomrenierappeals.com. And you can also find phone number there where you can call and leave a message.
Spell your last name real quick.
Regnier.
Well, you've been listening to Legal News and Review. Tune in coming up this Wednesday for an outrageous show. I'm Phil Bell, along with
Gary Ostro.
And, of course,
Tom Renier.
Be safe.
You've been listening to the award-winning Legal News and Review, recognized by the Florida Bar's Award of Excellence. Legal News and Review, featuring Michael Santucci from the law firm of Santucci Priori, located in downtown Fort Lauderdale, and practicing intellectual property, business, and entertainment law and litigation. They can be reached at 500law.com or at 954-351-7474. To contact the legal panel hosts and guests, go to belegalbuzz.com. And to reach Gary Singer, board-certified real estate and syndicated columnist, appearing in 400 media outlets, including the front page of the Money Section every Monday in the Sun Sentinel, from the law firm of Gary M. Singer, PA, call 954-851-1448 for Legal News and Review. Remember, be legal.